The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, if you know anyone who has diabetes, my guest in the second part of our program, Dr. Julian Whitaker, one of the nation's most prominent, respected alternative medical practitioners specializing in orthomolecular medicine and diabetes and heart disease and anti-aging, will be here to talk about the good, the bad, and the stupid. We're going to critique the conventional views and treatment of diabetes and show you its alternatives. Also today, this auto engine runs on air, never needs to change its oil. I'll give you that information, and then you can begin a little research quest. Also today, the latest on the environment. The dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico is increasing, and I'll give you the latest on nuclear. Let's begin. Now they have found a molecule that turns on the immortality gene. This is from PR News, and it's based on some science here from Harvard Medical School, published in the journal Nature, which is considered the most respected scientific publication in the world. When expressed, meaning turned on, the gene HTRT, located on the chromosome number 5P15-33, activates the enzyme telomerase. Human cells can keep living and dividing indefinitely when telomerase is continually present, meaning the cells become immortal. Telomerase activation sciences announced that this TA65 can extend human cell life indefinitely. It's a single molecule telomerase activator that turns on the immortality gene under controlled laboratory conditions. All right, well, we know where they're going with this. They're going to try to find a chemical, a drug, that they can use to extend the lifespan indefinitely of different genes in the body. Okay, now, that's far off in the future. Here's what's right now. By the way, I'm broadcasting from our studios and streaming over the video from our studios in New York City. In a week, we should have our new studios complete. 6 cameras, monitors, it'll be a substantial improvement. High-def cameras and a big studio. Right now, we're in our smaller studio. In any case, for years, as the lead anti-aging scientist at the Institute of Applied Biology, I was first able to show in rats how I could extend their lifespan, allowing a normal 12-month lifespan to become 14 or 16 months just by fasting them on a weekly basis for a period of time. Then I showed that by giving them an enriched environment, enriched meaning that the rat wasn't in the little cage, which I consider very inhumane, but instead could run anywhere they wanted in this whole floor on the third floor of this institute, and then hiding their food, having to be very creative in finding the food, playing different music that I saw allow them to, you can actually read the energy when you see a rat's hyper and not. And also, then feeding the rats different phytonutrients. Instead, for a whole year, I gave them no water, but made fresh juice every day. Well, 98% of juice is water, so they got their water, but in the form of a living organic juice, like wheatgrass juice, or vegetable juice, or fruit juice. And with each one of these, by itself, I could extend the lifespan. That meant that I was extending the lifespan of the telomere, which meant that I was affecting telomerase, the very same chemical process that they're now looking for the magic drug that will turn this on indefinitely. I also found that exercise did this. So now let's just put it all together and see what we have. The more things you do of a constructive nature that allow the telomerase in your body, the telomeres, that are in capped in on the chromosomes to live longer and stay longer the longer you live, the longer that system lives. That's good. Today we know that different phytonutrients, like chlorophylls, green vegetables and red fruits, are extremely powerful in protecting the telomeres and actually extending their life. So hence, the more fruits and vegetables or their juices or concentrates that we take, the longer we're going to live, the less disease we will have. But I also found out, because I was simultaneously doing energy work that wasn't officially approved, but some of the scientists would come up, including the director of the institute, who knew fully well what I was doing, and would sit in all kinds of experiments to see how they went. In fact, I was the first person, I don't say that to brag, just to establish some timeline in 1975 to do an experiment where we had a group of people come up who claimed that they had the capacity to influence positive outcomes with energy. All right, that's a theory. It's a hypothesis. But we had a group of seeds of three different types, bunches of seeds, all from the same group. So therefore, they got the same amount of light, water. The only difference in each room, one of the people went in the room and just sat there who had no abilities at all and read for 15 minutes. In one of the rooms, a person went in and did their meditation or prayers or whatever it was they felt was a way of conveying the energy they had. I had nuns, I had priests, I had rabbis, I had a medicine man, I had a medicine woman. I had all these people who claimed from different neighborhoods and boroughs that they had this capacity. I had a chiropractor, Dr. Martin Jacobs. I had a rabbi, Abraham Wiseman. Indeed, a high percentage of these people were able to change the growth rate of the sprouts. Now, there was a ruler in the soil, and there was a camera there, stationary, and hence we had time-lapse photography. And then the third group, nothing. It was just sprouts growing. Now, they all had the same sprouts, same soil, same light. The group that had just the light in the soil, nothing else, grew as it was expected. Full maturity of the particular type of sprout we were growing in 7 days. The group that had a person reading, no different. The group that had the persons emanating this energy by whatever mean and from whatever source they claimed, sometimes a 300% increase in the growth rate. Not only that, but it was richer in chlorophyll. So clearly there was a phenomenon that occurred. An energy had been transferred, which opened up the idea that there was a real science to explore the kinetic energies, the ethereal energies, the energies that a person emanated. Now they may have believed that their energy came from a particular source. That didn't mean it was provable, but we could prove that there was a transfer of energy. That would be extremely important in my work, because I then realized that the missing equation in medicine was the compassion, the sensitivity, the care of a physician sitting with a patient. I didn't know at the time that there were a group of physicians in the South, and these physicians would sit with the patient and pray with them. The results they got were substantially better than patients getting the same type of treatment elsewhere without the physician. These were generally Christian physicians who believed that that kind of ministering ministered the soul and not just the body. In any case, all this was happening. None of it was in the media. But Stanley Krippner and a lot of other people at institutions and universities, all of us were sharing information. But I was the one who had the lab doing the work. But nobody had the confidence to take this public, because it would have seemed like something too esoteric, too existential to the common thought. So it was done quietly. Now here's where we go with this. I decided to do an experiment. I enlisted 500 people from this audience. Some people listening now probably will remember this. These are all people to get into this study had to have been overweight without positive benefit of diets for 2 years. Then the people were divided into five separate 100-person groups. Each day, they came, 100 together, but none of them meeting or talking with the other group. This went on for 6 months. It was done at the Jewish Center on West 86th Street, Manhattan. Group A, for example, the one group, got what we would consider the perfect glycemic diet. It was just the right amount of fats and fiber and carbohydrates, quality proteins, vegan, and all the nutrients they would need from that diet. But that's all they got. Another group got an exercise program. As we know, that the more exercise you do that is systematic, you change over your metabolism. Hence, you are more efficient at burning calories. And the more sedentary you are, the less calories you burn and the more fat you accumulate, especially fat in the posterior and abdomen areas. The third group got all the supplements that were known to impact lipogenesis or fat elimination. And if it was something like creatine monohydrate and conjugated linoleic acid, all of the best nutrients, but nothing else. The fourth group got stress management, yoga, meditation, deep breathing, all the different types, biofeedback, all the different types, including neuro-linguistic programming, anything that had been shown to benefit a person at a stress level, because a lot of people get stressed and they sublimate by overeating. Therefore, the less stressed you are, the less likely you are to be overweight. The last group got none of that. The only thing the last group got was a question. And this is a question that's very important. What in your life, what in your belief systems, what in your reality day to day, today, would you be able to challenge and say, that doesn't work for me today? I can't support that today. So it was a challenge to the underlying foundational beliefs. In effect, the idea that much of our life is based upon other people's beliefs and we're simply acting them out. If they want us to go to college, they want us to have a certain career, more often than not, we'll honor that. If they want us to be a really good student and study hard from being very young as a kid and have tutors and get A's and get into better schools and private schools and go to Harvard and so we can be the best and the brightest and go down and get the best jobs, all possibly with the best of intention, and we do that, does that make us a better person? Are we really benefited from that education? Because when we get down to Wall Street, we're going to find that there are 160,000 other best and brightest, summa cum laude, magna cum laude, first in their class, valedictorian, and they're all stressed to the max, and they generally don't know what to believe in, except more is better, so let's get in here and make decisions, even if we don't have to use moral judgment in the decisions we make. And I simply ask them, if you can determine that a decision is not moral, if it's not ethical, if it's not right, would you have the confidence and the courage to say no to it? If something is not positive, can you say, no, I don't want that? If people are negative, can you challenge that idea that you should be a sponge for someone else's negativity? Can you stop the endless, I forgive you for the sin of this, I forgive you for the indiscretion of that, I forgive you for the attitude, and simply say, sorry, no more. You've used up your goodwill tickets. There's no more admission to my life for those people who are using me as a punching bag. And simply no longer take their calls and say goodbye. That's what I dealt with the last group. At the end of 6 months, here were the approximate statistics. The group that had the perfect diet, where everything they needed to know about nutrition, 93% failure rate. Supplements, about the same. Exercise, a little less, it was about 85%. Stress management, about 90% failure rate. Changing your belief system, 93% success rate. So the missing equation, I felt then, in all counseling and all healing was first start with a foundational system of beliefs, because if you give a perfect diet, perfect information, perfect anything, and if the person's foundational beliefs are not able to absorb that information and utilize it and surrender what is wrong and negative, then they're going to keep taking the good information, the good inspiration, the good energy to the dark side of their nature, and they will self-sabotage everything you do for them. I then applied those principles to the drug interdiction program through Trafalgar Hospital and the Institute of Applied Biology, which had a joint project, one of the major ones in the United States, and I headed that, and I counseled thousands of drug addicts. When I looked at them and said, do not stand up and say you're a drug addict. If you do that, you've just empowered the tapes in your subconscious to go ahead and start processing energy from that. Instead, simply say, my name's Damien, I made some really stupid choices in my life, and now I am at a point where I'm paying the consequences for those. I'm going to learn the lesson of those choices, and therefore ask myself, do I want to repeat this lesson, or do I want a better lesson without the pain of others or myself? I had a tremendous success rate, and that's the program I've used to this day, incorporating first foundational beliefs. Now, in this concept, you're using everything based upon the foundation that the person has an idea of who they really are making decisions from their spiritual and honest, authentic self and not the conditioned self. The persons most likely not to follow this program are the most radicalized in their beliefs, the true believers. They don't give that up. Hence, they don't benefit. Also, the political ideologues, those the ramrod, rigid idealist in their political beliefs, the Marxists, the communists, the anarchists, the capitalists, they don't change. I haven't seen that in my experience. And as a result, all the other good information you share with them doesn't make them warm and kind and fuzzy around the edges. They still are as combative and as resistant and arrogant in their beliefs as you could imagine. The people most likely to most make changes are people who've learned through crisis. In other words, they took their belief system right down to their disease, to their dysfunction, to their bankruptcy, to their crisis, then faced with no other option, how in the hell did I get here? Why am I in this hospital bed with a stroke? Why in the world do I have to keep putting on a belt that doesn't fit around my waist? Why is it that I can't walk up a set of steps without feeling like my heart's going to break? Then they stop and ask a question. That question frequently reveals the truth. Now bring that to the person most likely to slow down the aging process, to lengthen those telomeres, to respect the genes that can allow us to live much longer lives and much healthier, are the happy choices. Happy people get less cancer. Happy people have a different concept of life. Most people, however, are truly not happy. They may have happy moments. They have even maybe remarkable moments. But by and large, day to day, most people live with the boredom, the redundancy. Gee whiz, like Groundhog Day. Haven't I been here, done that, eaten that, drank that, smoked that, talked about that, gossiped about that, and distracted myself from my own life? Yeah. Well, what am I going to do about it? Well, same thing. Take a Quaalude, take a tranquilizer, get a diagnosis, go shopping, go buy something, do something really stupid. Well, how's that going to change anything? It won't, except you will speed up your aging process, you'll die sooner, your telomeres will shorten, and all the drugs in the world that promise longevity won't work. But if there's a promise of immortality out there, why should I have to change anything, my attitude, my beliefs, if I know I can take that drug? Well, unfortunately, that's how many people live today. Why should I be responsible for the long-term consequences of my choices if someone's going to be the safety net to keep me from falling? And by the way, we currently have a whole generation of young people who, no matter what they do, if they want to swan dive with arrogance and hubris, indifference and conceit off a building, their parents, grandparents, siblings, society, teachers, rabbi, minister, nuns will all jump out there and use their bodies and minds and resources to break their fall. Hence the lesson learned, none. So we are at the very low point of being able to learn from a foundational level. Change the values, change the beliefs. More on this on upcoming programs. So when I look at something that says, oh, gee, we have a pill coming, I'm saying that's the last thing we need. We have the information now to live longer and healthier lives. We just have to put it all together, the pieces that make sense. Next up, apples top the most pesticide-contaminated list. Now, I've been telling you about apples in a good way. This is USA Today. Here are the dirty dozen. Here are the things that they're not organic. Don't eat them. Don't juice them. Apples, celery, strawberries, peaches, spinach, nectarines, grapes, sweet bell peppers, potatoes, blueberries, lettuce, collard greens, and kale. Here, however, are the best items that, if they're not organic, at least are least toxic, because not everybody will find organic all the time, but these are at least the cleanest. Onions, corn, pineapple, avocado, asparagus, sweet peas, mangoes, eggplant, cantaloupe, kiwi, cabbage, watermelon, sweet potatoes, grapefruit, and mushrooms. A new test, a urine test, can help detect cancers of the gut, stomach, and pancreas much earlier than existing procedures. This is at the University of Edinburgh Tissue Injury and Repair Group, and they found that they have isolated different chemicals in urine that can show you two proteins, S100A6 and S109, most likely to appear in samples from cancer patients. Ask your physician about that test. It's harmless. And finally, how green foods can reduce excess acidity. And many times you'll hear people saying, we eat your fruits and vegetables. Good. And the reason why is because they're at the top of any health pyramid. And by the way, I have my own health pyramid that I created that's on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Well, there are hundreds of different chemicals designed to keep our bodies in top working order. Nearly all the fruits and vegetables help counteract excessive amounts of acid in the body. And too much acid, or what we call local acidosis, will end up giving you high acid levels in the body. You can have fatigue, aches, pains, disruptive to your body's biochemistry. Now, in having a high acid level, which means a low pH, bad for you, a pH of 8.5 indicates excessive alkalinity or alkalosis. You don't want that either because you can end up with local alkalosis pain. The ideal, the body pH should be around 7.4, 7.5. And when you're eating meat, sugar, alcohol, processed foods, coffee, you are increasing acidosis. When you're eating your berries and your fruits and grains, you're creating a more alkaline medium. Tomatoes and citrus actually have an alkalizing effect when consumed. And even lemons and tomatoes are not contributing to your acid levels. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you to this program. I'm Gary Noll, broadcasting live and video streaming live from our studio in New York City. This is our issue of the day, and I'm going to share this with you and then ask you to call in and share your points of view. America for Sale. Is Goldman Sachs Buying Your City? I'll quote this from Dylan Radigan of the Dylan Radigan Show, a show I happen to like, by the way. He says, in Chicago, it's to sell parking meters to the sovereign wealth fund of the Emirates. In Indiana, it's to sell Northern Toll Road to a Spanish and Australian joint venture. In Wisconsin, it's public health and food programs. In California, it's libraries. It's water treatment plants, schools and toll roads, airports and power plants. It's Amtrak. There are revolving doors of corrupt politicians, big banks, and rating agencies. There are conflicts of interest. It's bipartisan. It's coming to a city near you. It may already be there. We're talking about the sale of public assets to private investors. You may have heard of one-off deals, but what we're exploring is something that is across the country. And while there are no television debates on this, there's no polling, there's no elections, who wins it will determine the literal shape of modern America. On Wall Street, setting up and running infrastructure funds is big business, with over $140 billion run by Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and Australia infrastructure specialist Macquarie. Now, that's what it's talking about. Here is the issue, and here's what I'd like you to think about. In the short term, with a $125 billion gap in the state budgets, the states are starting to cut back on everything from libraries to school programs and senior citizen assisted living centers, firefighters, closing down fire departments. I say this is wrong. And what they're going to do is they're going to sell off all these assets. Now, they'll get some money initially. And a lot of that money is borrowed by these companies from the Federal Reserve, which means guaranteed by us. So while they're eviscerating social programs, they're borrowing money to do all this and loading it up with debt, so the state gets cash that was made frequently by the Federal Reserve and given to these organizations. And then what do they get? They then get to privatize America. What does that mean? Well, recently I was in Orlando lecturing and doing a PBS special. In a very short period of time, we stopped three times, my driver, to put money in a toll. In a short little road, three times. It came to about $6. They will ultimately try to get the big deals, like the bridges, so they can put a toll so you can't go across the river unless you pay a toll. They will make out like bandits. And then everything they do then is privatized. Now, with a privatized prison system now, it's in their economic interest to make sure that the legislators are lobbied to make more people go to jail. Hence the war on drugs, which we shouldn't have. It's an asinine drug deal, and I'm going to be doing a whole program on why we have failed in all of our wars, war on cancer, war on drugs, and what we could do in their place. But right now, you're going to be seeing over the next 2 years enormous privatization. And none of these private issues are run better than what competent people within the state or federal government could run. So, your thoughts. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Now we're going to go into our studio in New York, and I want to read this to you. I thought you'd find this interesting. And then for those of you who are sleuths or like to research, this is a challenge for you. I'm going to quote verbatim from the Christian Science Monitor, August 24th. Successful operation of a six-cylinder automobile motor whose only fuel is compressed air points to a time when motor cars may travel for years without gasoline, oil, or water, according to the inventor Obed M. Smith of Miami, who already has driven a car thus equipped 9,000 miles through 11 states without stopping at a filling station. In a recent exhibition, his invention, Mr. Smith, who says he literally grew up with engines, opened the throttle and eased less than 5 pounds of air into the new motor, which after a slight prodding of the flywheel caught in moving along at an even rhythm. The exhaust could be seen emitting a light vapor. Practically no vibration was noticeable on the engine block, and it was possible to place a hand on the motor after it had been running for 15 minutes. Then it was no warmer than the sun might heat it up. Its only fuel being compressed air, the motor needs no wires, no gears, no ignition, no water cooling system. There is a small device for keeping the air at an even temperature, one of the secrets of the invention. The construction is simple enough, and cost is said to be many times less than that of the cheapest motor of today. The motor is 4 inches wide, 29 inches long. The pistons have 2.5-inch diameter and 3.5-inch stroke. The six-cylinder engine tunes up to 5,000 revolutions a minute and develops 62.5 horsepower. Mr. Smith has experimented air pressure for 25 years. He was 15 years in perfecting the present motor. Before going to Miami, he operated a garage in Chicago for several years. He drove an automobile with a converted gasoline motor using compressed air on 9,000 miles toward the United States and climbed Pike's Peak as easily as if it were level. He intends to install a 150-pound pressure tank on the rear of the car, similar to the present gasoline tank. This may be filled in the beginning at any filling station with the air used for inflating tires. The crankcase is filled with oil to lubricate the moving parts, but as there is no heat, oil never has to be changed. So stops at filling stations be rare, as the moving car will renew air in the tank by 4 compressors operated on the rear brake drums. By means of a device in the motor, 85% of the air used in the motor is returned to be used over again. So there's a little chance of running out of air, the inventor maintains. And now, here's the key. Christian Science Monitor, page 1, front page, Miami, Florida, 1937. All right? What happened to this engine? What happened to its inventor? Why don't we have this today? Thought I'd share that with you. Now into our studio. Of course, some of you watched that debate and the Republicans, and it's more interesting to watch a Three Stooges movie. At least you know that the Three Stooges were comedians. This is from the latest sports report, and it says, quote, viewer poll on Republican debate, 25% undecided, 75% unconscious. New Hampshire, quote, and what could spell trouble for the current fielder of gubernatorial presidential candidates? A poll of likely voters who saw this past weekend's debate found it numbing. Additionally, over half the respondents agreed with the statement, quote, this field of candidates comes dangerously close to qualifying as a prank. Despite this somewhat tepid response, the debate did have its moments of excitement, such as Representative Michelle Bachmann's official announcement of her candidacy, quote, I want to declare my candidacy here in New Hampshire, the home of the Boston Tea Party. Representative Bachmann received high marks in the poll from voters who said they found former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin too cerebral. And while Governor Palin is not yet an official candidate, she told reporters, quote, if I do run for president, I'm going to come riding in like Paul Revere at the Alamo. Governor Rick Perry of Texas offered this statement. At this time, I can't decide whether to run for president of the United States or secede from the United States and become president of Texas. And former Governor Mitt Romney made the most headlines last night by offering voters this guarantee. I will never get involved in a scandal like Wienergate because Mattel toys did not give me my genitals. Unquote. So, and that's that. In about 8 minutes, we're going to our guests in studio. We have Elizabeth here, who reads your emails, but we also have Val. Hi, Val. You just came down from production. What's going on?
Hi, Gary. I just wanted to let everyone know that your documentary, Death by Medicine, is doing really well. It's won 8 awards so far, very prestigious awards, the Rising Star Award in Canada, the Best Documentary in Hoboken, the Gold Kahuna in Hawaii, the Golden Ace in Las Vegas, in Connecticut, the Extraordinary Achievement, Official Best Award, and the Golden Remy Award in the World Fest Houston Award. International competition, and that was out of 4,300 entries and in 10 categories, and Death by Medicine won a gold Remy, so congratulations.
Good. Well, it's my hope that no later than 3 months from now we'll have our official opening of Death by Medicine. But we have so many documentaries, as you know, that we're working on, including the one you're currently working late to get done, because we're going to qualify two of these for Academy Awards, and we'll have official release of these, one in August, one in October, one in November, one in December. So we have four heavy-hitting, socially relevant documentaries coming at us. But right now, we have more material film than we have editors to edit and producers to sit with the editors and to edit. So we could use at least four new people working who have experience in producing to sit with what I've already filmed, because every day I'm filming, as you know, mm-hmm. but we've been doing so much filming around the world that we've got a backlog, and these are really important topics. So we have the equipment. We have the brand new editing machines we brought in here, but we need people. Give us your number there so people can...
Of course, you can call me, Jason, at 646-926-5428.
Okay. That's for positions of... We're also needing two research editors that will do research over the Internet, and to help us on some of our scholarly reports, we need an office manager. We're interviewing for that. So we've got a lot of things coming up. Thank you, Val.
Thank you.
And
While I'm here, I just wanted to go and talk to our listeners a little bit, because our numbers keep growing weekly by 10 to 15%. I want to thank them for their continuous support and to let them know, to let other people know, so that we can keep informing everyone daily, because it's great to see that everyone keeps growing with us. So please continue.
I don't want to talk about it yet, but we have two of what will be the most phenomenal programs in all of broadcasting coming in the next month. We have two programs. One is called the Progressive News Hour, where we're going to have 15 of the greatest progressive minds in the world. I'll just let you know that people like Chris Hedges and others of that quality are on board. We were also going to have a Progressive Spiritual Hour, correct, where you have, I don't want to mention any names, but yeah, all the best in the country are on board.
They're already getting back to us about it, so it's been a nice response.
So we're very pleased about that. Thank you. Now, we're going to go to my guest in a second, who's standing by, but Elizabeth's in the studio. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gary. We've received an email from a person, no name. They teach philosophy, so they're obviously probably a professor. They've been listening for 2 years on KPFK, but for 6 hours on this Wednesday show, this morning, actually, he said that they said that their head exploded when you talked about something. They had an epiphany this morning, and they'd only had one other in their life, and this was when they were 18 years old, so this is a really big, you know, moment in their awareness. Do you realize how radical your statement was, they're saying? They would hope you could discuss it in greater detail. They're going round today and speaking with their colleagues to reconsider their ideas based on what you said, to come to a new understanding on how the USA has not changed for the better, and how people of all generations are not doing anything. They cannot tell you how extreme the shift has been in their consciousness. They're saying, please could you share your views again today, as they've gathered together colleagues in philosophy, human behavior, psychology, and the social sciences to listen to your show today at noon via Progressive Radio Network. The topic you discussed was, we cannot change either as individuals or as a society or as institutions if it's not being sanctioned by official acceptance. Would you please be able to reiterate now in a few minutes and give us a better understanding of what made this person so excited by what you said this morning? Thank you.
Okay, this will tie into my guest, Dr. Julian Whitaker, who is standing by now to talk about diabetes. What I said this morning is the following. Virtually all of our institutions, all of them, every single one in the United States, has a limited understanding of a problem and a solution. So let's say that you have a solution that works. Let's say you're Julian Whitaker and you have a traditional background. You graduate from Dartmouth and Emory University School of Medicine, and you see that the traditional approach to heart disease with statins or psychiatric problem with antidepressants, it not only doesn't work, but the patient actually gets worse. But through your own study and then clinical experience, you find there's another way. By changing the diet and detoxification and rejuvenation, now you have a patient that's healthier. Now, here's the idea, and this is how it all connects, in no matter what field you're in. What is the likelihood that the official institutions and their official spokespersons, in this case the USDA, the FDA, the CDC, the U.S. Public Health Service, the National Cancer Institute, National Academy of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, all these institutions, and then at the state level, and then the medical community and the scientific community will all gather around, and the media reported that we have a new way of looking at the nature of a problem and a new way of helping solve it. It's not going to happen. To the contrary, just the opposite. If you are an innovative scientist like Julian Whitaker or all the others in the country, if you cured every patient using natural methods, you would end up on everyone's suspect list. Because imagine this. How's it going to look for the other 920,000 scientists if there are 2,000 of your physicians that are getting your patients well using natural techniques, and they're not? So now the official position always protects those who are following official positions. So the media is neither left nor right. That's a myth. It is official. So if you're a Democrat or a liberal, a Republican or a conservative, at Fox, Bill O'Reilly is accepted, no matter how inane and egotistical his statements, because it's official. The New York Times is official. MSNBC, a division of NBC, is official. So all these official positions can argue as if they know the problem and the solutions. Neither of them understand the true type of problem. If they did, they would have reinserted the Glass-Steagall Act, and they would have stopped giving any money to any corporation, and they would allow those corporations to restructure under bankers. They would have stopped home foreclosures. They chose not to do it. They would have had universal health care. They've chosen not to do that. We would have stopped companies from polluting the environment. They chose not to do that. Not because they're stupid. They are not. But because it's not official. There's an official way. If you're a Democrat, there's an official way of looking at the world and its problems and solution. Republican, the same way. But they are not in alignment with the truth. So even if you were a journalist, if you came here and said, Gary, and I'll understand that you work with 12 persons with AIDS over a 16-month period, and you had all their blood chemistry, and through the medical intervention, you reversed their condition. Yes, here it is. But I just spoke with the National Cancer Institute and its division of AIDS, and they say it's not possible. So as an official journalist at the New York Times or the Los Angeles Times, New York Post, I cannot advocate this, even if my evidence shows otherwise, because if I do, I'm going to lose my official access, and then I'll be looked upon as promoting unproven methods. So we've got it, but hold on a second. The very methods you promote are the ones that kill the most people and injure the most people. Why don't you take away the license of every doctor that gives an antibiotic, which is for bacteria, gram-negative bacteria, to a person with a cold, which is the flu, which is a rhinovirus or a virus, which won't work at all and hurt the person's immune system. And there are 33 million of those given in a year. But that's official medicine, therefore can it be judged? It cannot be deemed inappropriate because it's official. So I see if it's an official war, no matter what the outcome, no matter what the consequence, no matter what the lies, it's official. Therefore, it's sanctioned. So Bush has sanctioned the war. And now we have sanctioned wars. Therefore, they're official. Whether Republican or Democrat, they're officially supported. So it's an official support. The Patriot Act officially supported. The fascist, creeping fascists in America, it's officially supported. So you can't call it fascism. I see. So no matter what I do, no matter what I see, no matter what I say, if it's not official, it cannot be accepted. And that is correct. And that is the problem. If you're a good teacher, but you see that how you believe teaching should be taught, if you challenge the curriculum, and if the official curriculum is not what you're teaching, then you are going to get a rubber room. Suspension. If you are the doctor or the scientist who decides that what you're doing is not ethical, but it's officially accepted, then you're the one who is now the troublemaker. And that's why now the people who are becoming progressives and independents are realizing the limitations of all institutions. Oh, did we forget the current pope was also the cardinal who oversaw hiding the pedophilic priest? But that's when it was done officially, so we can't criticize it. Now he's the pope, it can't be criticized. And we can't criticize Bush because it was official. And torture, waterboarding was official. You see, once you add official to anything, it cannot be changed. In anything, anywhere, at any time. If you choose to, you have to go outside of the system. Now, once you're outside the system, you lose all power, all authority, all respect. I can name you at least a dozen Nobel Prize winners who found that what their belief was, from Kerry Mullis to Linus Pauling, who today are not respected in their given fields because they challenged the status quo. And therefore, they were a threat to the established beliefs and the sustainability of that belief system. Hope that answers that question.
Thank you.
Let's go over and say hello to my guests. I'm going to go a little longer on the show. I'm going to ask those of you who are listening. We will continue this interview with Dr. Joan Whitaker that got started a little later than normal. And you'll be able to hear this interview in its entirety by going to progressiveradionetwork.com when your land-based station stops this particular part of the program at a certain time. Nice to have you with us today, Dr. Whitaker.
Hey, nice to be with you, Gary. I love your information, and I love the way you deliver it.
Thank you. Dr. Whitaker, I'm going to give you just two questions, and I'll sit by and listen with our audience. Diabetes is an epidemic, not only in adults, but type 2, adult diabetes, in children.
Correct.
I would like for you to tell us why we have this scourge and epidemic and why the American Diabetic Association and other official institutions, and including our Surgeon General and U.S. Public Health Service, have been engaged in such ineffective methods of dealing with it, and then what you and others who support a different approach to it have been able to do, and what your results are and what your protocols are. The forum is yours.
I, at Whitaker Wellness, which has been in business since 1979, continuously, we have treated probably 35,000 diabetic patients. Our method is different, but in order to understand our method, you need to understand exactly what diabetes is. Diabetes, the word, has nothing to do with sugar. Diabetes means excessive urination. There are several diabetic conditions, diabetes insipidus, which is a hormone-derived excessive urination, but diabetes is excessive urination. Diabetes mellitus, mellitus comes from the Greek word meaning honey. Diabetes mellitus is the sugar diabetes that we conjure up when we say the word diabetes. The question is, why does diabetes mellitus have excessive urination? The answer to that is also simple. Most of this stuff is just mind-boggling simple. Sugar in large amounts in the blood becomes a diuretic. It becomes an osmotic diuretic. Now, as the sugar goes in normal people from, say, 70 to 150 after a meal, there is no sugar in the blood. But when the blood sugar goes up to 190, 260, 310, the sugar becomes an osmotic power. To understand osmotic power, all you have to think of is taking a goldfish and dropping it into the Great Salt Lake. Now, the osmotic power of the Great Salt Lake will suck the fluid out of the goldfish and will kill it. The osmotic power in the blood, the sugar attracts massive amounts of water to it. And then it rushes into the kidney like a tsunami. It overwhelms the kidney's capacity to reabsorb sugar. Normally you find no sugar in the urine. But when you have this tsunami of fluid flowing in, it's overwhelming the kidney. And not only do you have sugar in the urine, but you have everything else. You have B6, magnesium, zinc, chromium, sodium. You have everything else being washed out by this diuretic effect of the sugar in the blood. Now, what are the consequences of that? Well, diabetes is a condition which causes complications. Only rare do you find a death from diabetes. But diabetes is the number one cause of blindness in people over 65. It's the number one cause of kidney replacement because the kidney is shut down. Number one cause of amputation because of the ulcers that develop in diabetics. And a dramatic increase in heart disease. All of these are complications of the condition, but one of the problems that you face when you look at the diabetic nutritional status is it is in the toilet in everything. There was a study published back in 1970, I think it was, which compared the magnesium levels in a diabetic population and the magnesium levels in a normal population. And they found that the diabetic population couldn't even reach the average level of the normal population with the blood levels. And they found that in the diabetic population, magnesium by itself, low magnesium, was an independent risk factor for diabetic retinopathy and blindness. Now, if you're treating a diabetic and you know that he's having this osmotic loss of nutrient, the first thing you would expect someone to do that has this rudimentary understanding of the mechanics of the diabetic condition is to tell his patient, listen, you are losing nutrient. You're losing it every time you go to the bathroom. Here is a packet of multiple vitamins containing all the water-soluble vitamins as well as everything else. You take these vitamins to prevent your eyes from going bad, to prevent your legs from going bad, to prevent your kidneys from going bad. And it works. That the study with the magnesium was titled Low Magnesium Levels as an Independent Risk Factor for Diabetic Retinopathy. Now, independent means it doesn't matter what your control was. If you had low magnesium levels, you're going to develop retinopathy farther, faster than any other people with diabetes, all other things considered. So our first goal is to give patients vitamins. Now, we have an epidemic of type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes, it's not hard to figure it out. Type 2 diabetes is always associated and brought on by obesity. If we have type 2 diabetes in kids, it's because the kids are much fatter. So type 2 diabetes requires weight loss. Now, we have drugs to treat type 2 diabetes. Back in the 60s, these drugs were put to a double-blind placebo-controlled trial in which they were only looking now at complication rates. They found at the end of the study, actually they had to terminate the study, because in a double-blind placebo, nobody knew who was getting what, but 6 years into the 8-year study, one group had 300% higher rates of heart attack and heart death. It was a statistical and mathematical impossibility for the two groups to change or become similar. So they found out what they wanted from the study, and they broke the code. And lo and behold, the people that were dying from those that were taking Oronase and dying from those who were taking DBI, and those drugs are still on the market in the presence of glyburide and metformin. Now, glyburide is quite interesting. Glyburide carries a warning on patient information that glyburide will increase the risk of heart attack. So patients become kind of, you know, adjusted to the fact that they're under treatment for diabetes, and they think they take the pill regularly just as the doctor ordered, and right on the label it says it increases their risk of dying from a heart attack. So they resist my recommendation to stop it immediately. And they say, well, I don't want to stop it. I've been taking it for 5 years. Stop it immediately, or you can take your choice. You can take the glyburide and have a 300% chance of dying from a heart attack, or you cannot take the glyburide and have a much lower risk of heart attack. You make the decision. And to tell you something, Gary, the way we treat doctors when we're patients, they have a difficulty even with that kind of decision-making. But let's take the real, absolute insane practice in type 2 diabetes. You see, type 1 diabetes, which is about 8% of the population, they have damaged islet cells in the pancreas. Their pancreas is not producing insulin. So their blood sugar levels go very high. The four signs and symptoms of type 1 diabetes is, number one, excessive urination from the very high blood sugar levels. Number two, excessive drinking, which is polydipsia. Number three, they eat huge amounts of food. But number four, the type 1 diabetes always has substantial and rapid weight loss. So you have to have insulin in that group to stabilize the metabolism. I don't go for the insulin pumps. I think the research done on transplanting islet cells is just nonsense. I go just give them some insulin, you correct the problem, and give them a lot of vitamins and minerals, and they're going to do just fine.
Well, then tell us, Dr. Whitaker, what do you do to help a person? Give us your protocol in the next few minutes here.
Okay. Type 2 diabetes, I put them on a very limited calorie diet. I tell them, don't eat breakfast. Go for exercise, just eat normal lunch and dinner. Lose weight. If you don't lose weight, nothing's going to work. I have them exercise, and I give them large doses of vitamins. There's nothing else needed for type 2 diabetics.
Which supplements do you give them?
And vitamins. Excuse me?
Which supplements do you suggest?
Oh, I give them everything. I give them everything because many of our supplements are water-soluble. And water-soluble supplements are the ones that are lost in the diet, in the excessive urination. So I give them that. I also have some supplement. Berberine has been shown to be very helpful with diabetes. Chromium has been shown to be helpful with diabetes. My multiple formula contains, my diabetic formula contains vanadyl sulfate. Vanadyl sulfate is actually a miraculous element for increasing the insulin sensitivity. So I give them vanadyl sulfate. But in general, I will give them large doses and consistent doses, which I point out to my patients, you take these vitamins because you're losing these vitamins with the condition, and if you take these vitamins, it will protect you from the complications. I went to Emory University Medical School. When this study came out, John Davison, who was the chief of the endocrine department and head of the diabetic treatment department at Emory, decided that he would not allow the use of any diabetic pill at Emory University. He also made the decision that he would not allow his interns, residents, chiefs of staff, and attendings to prescribe insulin to any diabetic who was not optimum weight. Now, so that's what we do. We don't use any diabetic drug of any kind until they're optimal weight. Then we will use insulin if they're optimal weight and still running relatively high blood sugars. And we give them vitamins and minerals. Now, he did that for 22 years. He retired in 1991. And now Emory, just like everybody else. The problem with insulin in the type 2 diabetic is that it puts on weight. It's unbelievable to me that I have known and have been preaching this. I've written a book about it. It's unbelievable to me that physicians and endocrinologists and diabetologists still give their type 2 diabetic insulin when it causes weight gain.
But Dr.
I've had patients who've gained 100 pounds taking insulin only to lose all the weight and all the need for medications and actually reverse the entire metabolic process.
Okay, keep in mind, Dr. Whitaker, they were prescribing the official therapy, which could not be challenged, and you were prescribing the non-official, which got the results. That goes back to what I was talking. We're out of time, Dr. Whitaker. Thank you very much for being with us. Dr. Whitaker is the author of many books, including Reversing Diabetes, Reversing Heart Disease, A Guide to Natural Healing, and The Pain Relief Breakthrough. It's drwhitaker.com. Thanks a lot for your input. Look forward to talking to you again. I'm Gary Nall, and that's the end of our show today. Ran a little over, and I thank you all for being with us today to listen in. We look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Now, for those of you who are asking, what can my teenagers listen to other than, you know, a silly little show? Well, how about a non-silly little show? How about the most popular show on the Internet for teenagers, Pure Imagination? That's the show, and we have Rachel Trachtenberg and Julia coming here in studio at the Progressive Radio Network to take on that big issue of finding the needs that are socially relevant issues. They take on some very serious topics here and gaining an enormous audience worldwide. Well, what are you all going to talk about today?
Today we have Yetta Curlin, who's going to come on and talk about... She ran for city council for the 3rd District and almost beat Christine Quinn. And she is running for mayor in 2013. We're going to talk to her about budget cuts and stuff that's going on. And we also have...
Desi K. Robinson, who's involved with Women in the Making Health and Social Summit for Girls, 11 through 19.
To get girls involved in healthy eating and exercise.
Great. We look forward to listening to you.
Thank you.
Back in a moment with Pure Imagination, all for teens who take life a little more seriously than the average one.
Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Taubenfeld.